Remember when you were a kid and you'd pull out a book and ask mom or dad, could you read me a story? And they'd start in, once upon a time. Didn't you love that feeling? And even as an adult, don't we love going to movies and seeing how stories are going to be displayed on the screen, how they're going to end? And stories are all over the place, aren't they? Our lives, we'll say to each other, you can't believe what happened to me last night. Movies are extremely popular art form these days. And what's that? Just a moving story on the screen. Television shows, stories galore. Of course, books. Thank goodness love of books hasn't gone away. So we get a lot of good stories in books. Social media. You go online on Facebook, people tell all sorts of stories there. How about history? Is that another good place to find stories? Sure. Amazing stories of famous people and things that they've accomplished. And then current events, just looking in the newspaper and seeing what's going on right now. Stories are surrounding us. And people remember stories, don't they? Why does a story have so much power? Well, examples and stories and illustrations all do something pretty powerful. One is they repeat the point or whatever it is you're trying to get across, and it merges meaning and emotions. So, for example, Jesus would tell parables. Now, he would say, there's a man that was doing this. There's a woman that was doing that. So he would try to explain what the kingdom of heaven was like, and he'd merge the meaning of whatever he's trying to get across. It might be kind of abstract for people, so he'd root it in the real world and have stories with emotions, with love and hate and murder and all these things that people do remember. So, well, what I'd like to suggest in the next few minutes is, as much as I love apologetics and I love all sorts of powerful informational pieces that I can give to individuals, reasons to believe that there's a God, reasons to trust the Bible, reasons to believe that Jesus is who he claimed to be. I mean, I love that stuff, and I love giving information. And I love supporting it with a lot of evidence, whatever my claim is. But here's what I'd like to suggest this time, that we can get across a lot of our apologetics information with stories and to emphasize stories. So what I'm going to do in the next few minutes is go through various aspects of apologetics basics, but focus on stories as illustrations rather than Bible verses or factual information. So let's start here. Let's consider an introduction to apologetics. And what we always say in our teaching classes is, we're supposed to always be ready. That's in 1 Peter. It says we're supposed to be ready to present evidence. So here, real quickly, two of my stories. I went to an ear doctor a while back, and when he got finished, he put everything down and started to get up and move on to his next patient. And he said, oh, he said, that's right, you're retired now. I said, what are you doing? Well, I thought, here goes nothing. And I said, well, I'm really interested in Christianity. You know, I'm trying to make a case for the truth of Christianity. He said, oh, really? And I thought he'd run for the door. But instead, he sat down and just stared at me and said, what do you mean? Could you explain that? Because he said, I've got some questions. And all of a sudden, we had probably a 10 or 15 minute discussion. And finally, a nurse had to come in and shoo him out and send him on to the next patient. So I sent him a follow-up letter and other things. But isn't that amazing? I wasn't expecting that. It just kind of came out of left field. Okay, one more quick story. And I bet you have things like this, too, where either you were ready and could express yourself clearly about the case for Christianity, or maybe you weren't ready and you always said, gee, I could have done so much better. All right, so here's my next story. I'm in the yard just doing some work, can't remember what, maybe 6 months ago. And a skateboarder went walking up the street with a skateboard under his arm, and he looked pretty hot. It was a warm day. And he stopped, and he looked over at me, and I looked at him, and I said, do you want something to drink? You look kind of hot. And he said, yeah. So I got him water, and we stood out there, and he said, I'm lost. And I said, oh, well, you're on such and such a street, and if you just go up a half a block, blah, blah, blah. But he kind of shook me off and he said, no, he said, I'm lost. And for some reason, just looking at him, I said, are you lost physically or spiritually? And he said, spiritually. Isn't that weird? I mean, I wasn't expecting that. And we ended up having a spiritual discussion for the next 10-15 minutes. So again, I'm not saying I'm doing anything terrific. I'm just saying these things will fall into our laps, and we need to be ready. They happen. Here's another point about apologetics. I always tell people, you know, we want to show that Christians can think. We've been kind of stereotyped as mouth-breathing knuckle-draggers. Okay, so here's a story about that. A free throwaway magazine in San Diego County is called The Reader. And one time they sent a reporter down to Balboa Park, big park in San Diego, and they sent them to places where different religious groups set up booths and try to, you know, talk to people going by. Well, the atheists have a booth as well. And so the reporter said, he went to the atheist booth and said, "Tell me some stories of how you interact with Christians." And the atheist laughed. And he said there was a Christian that came by, and instead of engaging the atheist and trying to talk to him and explain what Christianity is all about, he just said, "I'll pray for you." And the atheist said, "I'll think for you." Now that's pretty powerful. It's kind of sad, isn't it? And so he had several stories of poor interaction between Christians and atheists. Very convicting stories there. Here's another story dealing with just the apologetics basics. And I always tell people when I'm talking about apologetics, I said, don't be afraid if somebody makes a claim, because often they don't know what they're talking about. Others, even if they have a lot of degrees after their names, don't necessarily know what they're talking about. So I tell the story of Richard Dawkins, a very famous atheist. Now, this guy is brilliant. He's a biology professor. I think he retired, but he was at Oxford University. So one time Richard Dawkins, when writing, said he believed Jesus never lived. And for evidence of that, he gave some kind of scholar. And so I'm sure a lot of Christians would say, "Ooh, I can't interact with that. Dawkins says, here's a guy with a bunch of degrees. Dawkins says he can't believe that Jesus ever lived." Well, other people took him to task and they said, "Who's this scholar that you quote?" You find out this guy had no background, that he's the person that he's quoting, had no background in historical studies. He was a German language professor. And so Dawkins later on had to back up and say, Jesus probably did live. So there's a story. Richard Dawkins makes claims and he can't back them up. And we need to be ready for that and realize people that make claims don't necessarily, even though they may look very confident, may not really have the goods to back up what they have to say. All right, here's another one. Again, we're just talking apologetics basics, telling stories to emphasize certain key points. We always say that just start in sharing your faith, you'll get better with practice. So I have a friend named Steve, and Steve loves sharing with other people. He became a Christian as an adult, so he knows what it was like being a non-Christian. So he decided to talk with Mormons, Jehovah's Witnesses, when they came to his door. Well, Steve said he just got so beat up psychologically, not physically, but just twisted into knots. The Mormons and the Jehovah's Witnesses were good. They knew their material. They study. And so they would throw verses at Steve, and Steve would say, I don't know, I'm not sure. And so he would come in after talking to them, sit down, and write down some of their questions, write down some of his responses, and study and practice and look up information. And you know, now he is happy to talk to Mormons, Jehovah's Witnesses. He's very comfortable. He knows what to expect. All of us get better at anything that we're practicing, including apologetics. Okay, let's move to another area of apologetics. I want to show you how some more stories will work here. Let's talk about arguments for the existence of God. Okay, using stories. So, what about the start of the universe? We say that there's a God because there has to be a cause for something, and the universe came into existence, so you need to explain where the universe came from. Okay, well, that's an argument, but it's kind of philosophical. So let's get real here. Let's tell a story. You wake up in the morning. You walk out to get your newspaper and you look next door and there's a brand new, hugely expensive Mercedes sitting in your neighbor's driveway. And your neighbor comes walking out about the same time and you say, "Hey, nice car." And he said, "Yeah." And you said, "Where'd that come from? Did you buy it?" "No, I didn't buy it." "Oh, did your wife buy it?" "No, she didn't buy it." "Oh, did the dealer bring it by to let you test drive it?" "No." "Well, where'd the car come from?" He says, "I don't know. We just woke up in the morning and found it in the driveway. It didn't come from anywhere. It wasn't from me. It wasn't from..." And you're going to, at that point, you're going to say, "Oh, wait a minute. The car didn't just materialize. It had to come from somewhere. Somebody brought it over. There was a cause behind the existence of that car." And we say the same thing about the universe. Where'd the universe come from? It had to come from somewhere, and it couldn't create itself. That car didn't create itself. And we say God is probably the best explanation. Well, what about the start of life? How did life come about? Well, I use a little illustration when we're talking about the difficulty to get life started. You remember years ago, kids had these things called pop beads. They were beads that had a neck at one end, a hole in the other end, and they would connect to each other, and you can make this big chain. And they were called pop beads because you could pull them apart and make that popping sound. Okay, well, I use that as an illustration of trying to turn amino acids into chains called peptides that could then fold into proteins. So I just physically bring some pop beads, and I say, "Take a look at the neck. It's like a little finger on one end." And I said, "That neck has to be a certain size, otherwise it won't fit in the other beads. For example, what happens if that neck is a little too thick, too big? It won't fit in the hole in the next one. What if that neck is a little too thin? It'll slide in, it'll fall right out, and you won't be able to stick these beads together." So it's just a simple illustration of how difficult it is to get amino acids to form in the right way into peptides. How about design in the universe? We're still arguing for the existence of God, but we're using stories. Well, there's a very famous old story. It's called Paley's watch story. And he says, if you come across a watch and you pick it up and you see all the gears and all the wonderful mechanisms inside there, you don't say, "Wow, isn't that amazing what time and wind and rain can do?" It's obviously a design item because of the way it works perfectly. And you can say the universe is just like that. There's design in the universe. Look at the human eye. Look at the way our blood system works. Look at the way the earth is. Look at the way our universe is. There are so many parameters that have to be exactly right. It's like a clock mechanism to create life here on earth. One more argument for the existence of God, and this has to do with the source of morality. So I like to use this illustration. I think it makes sense. Let's tell a story. You've never bowled, and you go with a friend who says, "I'm going to show you bowling." And your friend says, let's go meet at 4 o'clock. Okay, so you show up, and the person takes the bowling ball, shows you how you throw it down the lane, and he throws the first ball, and it goes in the gutter. And he says, "Great, that's 20 points for me." And you say, "That seems odd. You throw a ball in the gutter and you get points, and somebody in the next lane over says, 'Don't listen to him. That's not the standard. He's just creating his own standard.' There's a professional organization that has set up standards in bowling. If you use two balls, if you throw two balls and you knock down all the pins, you get 10 points plus whatever's on the next ball." "Oh, okay." So there's a standard. Nobody gets to create their own standards. The standards have to exist outside of individuals. And the same thing applies to God, obviously. That's where we're going to go with this. But do you see, you can tell this story, and that acts as a good argument for the existence of God. How about this? Let's move to another area of apologetics. This time, the uniqueness of Jesus. All you have to do, and I think it's a pretty simple thing, you can tell how interesting Jesus is, how smart he is. But if you want to tell about his uniqueness, all you have to do is to tell stories of Joseph Smith and Charles Russell and Muhammad and Mary Baker Eddy and the terrible things they all did and their shortcomings. You just tell those stories. And you say, okay, here's the story of Jesus. Where are those shortcomings? he's completely different, isn't he? Then I say, well, we're talking about the uniqueness of Jesus. We read some of the claims that Jesus made about himself, that he was the resurrection and the life, and that he would judge people, and that he would come again, and all this. Imagine if your pastor stood up on a Sunday morning and said a few of those things that Jesus had said and was talking about himself. What would happen? Well, pretty obvious. The congregation would vote him out of office and say he's a loon, he needs help. And yet Jesus said that, and people followed him and were willing to give their lives for him. Here's another story. Let's look at the resurrection of Jesus. Do you remember Chuck Colson and the Watergate story? Chuck Colson read the story of the resurrection, and he said some people think it was a conspiracy that the early Christians just got together and created that story. He says, really? He said, I went through Watergate. He said, you can't get people to keep a secret for very long when you put a little pressure to them. Okay? What about others say, well, okay, it wasn't a conspiracy, but Jesus didn't really die. That's how the story all happened, that he didn't really die. He fainted on the cross. They brought him down. And he was still alive. And that's the end of that. Really? Well, let's create a story about that. So, there's Jesus. He's on the cross. Remember, he's been scourged. He's been punched. He's had the crown of thorns. He's had a spear in the side. And the Romans don't mess with you. I mean, if they're supposed to kill you, they'll kill you. But let's suppose that he is alive, and he's taken off the cross. He's put in a tomb. He's wrapped with maybe 100 pounds of spices. A large stone seals the door. And now Jesus comes too, because it's cool. It feels good in there. And he gets out of the windings, all these wrappings. He gets the stone away from the door. He gets past the soldiers and the guards. He comes back to his disciples and staggers into the room. Now remember, we're just telling a story here to imagine this scene. He comes in that room and he says, I'm back from the dead. And his friends say, what? Do they say, you are the Son of God, we will go to our deaths to argue that? No, they're going to say, you are one lucky person. Lie down, we'll try to put you back together here. So that never made any sense to me, that he didn't really die. Here's another thing, thinking about the uniqueness of Jesus, his resurrection. Why do we believe in the resurrection? Where did Christianity start? In the very city that knew Jesus and saw him crucified and heard of his miracles and all. And Christianity spread from there. Okay, here's my story. What if I want to start a religion? I want to claim all sorts of special powers for myself. Am I going to start it in the city that knows me? Am I going to start it where my friends have seen me for years? Am I going to make claims of some kind of fabulous miracles that I can perform right there? No. People are going to say, we know you. You haven't done a single miracle. What am I going to do to get my religion off and running? If it was me, I'd go to somewhere in Asia or Africa. I'd find some place that nobody knew me and start making my claims. But Jesus and his followers, everything happened right there in Jerusalem. Okay, let's think about this. Here's another area of apologetics, the reliability of the Gospels. Let's just tell a couple of stories there. See, I want to take some time here to not argue for the truth of these things, but just to show you how you can use stories to illustrate the situation. Okay, so here we are, reliability of the Gospels. So you can make a claim that we have a lot of manuscripts that we can look at, and that helps create a reliability issue for the Gospels. Well, people are going to say, well, I guess, but I don't know what you're talking about. What about this? You tell a story. You say, okay, all of us in this room have an aunt, favorite aunt, and we love her to death, and she makes the best apple pie. Oh, it's just great apple pie. And then she's on her deathbed. And individually, people have come and gone talking to her, and they've said, aunt, before you go, could you give us a recipe for your apple pie? So she writes a recipe out for the first person, writes a recipe out for the second, and does it 10 times, let's say. And then she passes away. Well, so we all want to double check that we've got the right recipe. What if we only had one copy of her recipe? She only wrote it out one time. she might have made a mistake. She might have put cup for a size instead of a teaspoon. She might have put a tablespoon instead of a teaspoon. She might have said salt when she meant sugar. Because remember, she's not feeling real well. Well, what if you had 10? What if you had 20? What if you had 30 copies of her recipe? Do you think it's more likely that you could figure out what it was that she meant? Yeah, because she's going to write teaspoon in 20 of them and maybe tablespoon in one. Well, you can throw that tablespoon out because she had it right time after time. And that's how you do manuscript studies. You have the more manuscripts, the better chance you have of recreating what the original text was. And that's the same with the Christian documents. Okay, what about oral tradition? At first, the stories of Jesus probably circulated orally and eventually got written down. So a lot of people get nervous and they say, "Ooh, that's like the telephone game." So they're trying to use a story to illustrate this and say, telephone game, you start it off, people are in a circle, and somebody whispers a phrase to the person next to them who repeats it to the person next to them, and it goes around the room. When it comes back, it is so different. And people laugh and laugh because it's changed so much. Well, see, that's the people who are skeptical of Christianity and skeptical of the reliability of the gospel. So we have to get it clear that it's different than the telephone game, oral tradition. How is it different? Well, Jesus was speaking as a rabbi. People paid attention to rabbis. He spoke publicly. He didn't whisper in somebody's ear. He talked about important issues. It's not like the telephone game. Nobody cares if you get the message wrong in the telephone game, but Jesus talked about hell. He talked about life after death. He talked about how to treat other people, how to live in this world. So those are important things. And you can tell them the story. People can memorize an amazing amount of material. People used to memorize books of the Bible. Many Arabs memorized the Quran. So you can tell stories about that to illustrate the abilities that we have that we don't think we have to memorize. Let's talk about this for just a minute. So I've been telling you about the value of stories. Well, not all stories are useful. You've got to be careful. All right, so let me give you an illustration. So think about the stories that you're going to use. Think about the stories you hear. So have you ever heard the story of the blind men and the elephant? Okay, so here's the story, and then we'll talk about the problems with it. Ready? So there's a place in India, kind of in the backwoods part of India, and the people there have never seen an elephant. So the Raja, the ruler, brings an elephant in. And there are several blind people in this village. And he calls them over to check out the elephant. Well, one of the blind men feels the leg of the elephant and says, "Oh, I understand. An elephant's like a pillar." But meanwhile, there's a blind person who's feeling the trunk of the elephant. And he says, No. You got it wrong. The elephant's like a big vine." And now somebody else has grabbed the ear and is kind of waving it around. Remember, these are all blind individuals. And he says, "How mistaken you both are. The elephant's like a large fan." One more is grabbing the tail and says it's like a snake. One person feels the side and says it's like a wall. Now, here's the message. The person telling you the story then says, "This is like religions. All religions have a little bit of the truth, but they don't see the whole thing." And the Raja, the person who comes out and says, no, you're all wrong. You all have a piece of the truth. He represents a sighted person like the person telling you the story. Now, what's the problem with that? It's not a useful story. In fact, there's a major problem with it. The person telling you the story says, basically, "I am like the Raja. I can see, but all of you religious people are blind." Well, how's that for a piece of arrogance? How did this person get sight? Isn't that amazing? I mean, the whole story falls apart very quickly. This person says, in a sense, "I can see the truth about all religions and none of the rest of you can." Well, first of all, it's not true. And secondly, it's quite an arrogant statement to make. Okay, let's do another story. How about the justice of God? A lot of people say, "Well, God's kind. He'll overlook some problems." I'm basically a good person. Okay, well, let's tell a story. You have been driving for a long time, and you've probably stopped at 1,000 red lights. Well, that's good. You've stopped. You come to a complete stop. You look both ways, you wait, and then you get to go. And then you come to your 1,001st red light, and you don't see anybody, and you're kind of in a hurry, and there's no traffic, so you just zip right through it. A cop pulls you over, and you say to the cop, "Yeah, but I stopped at 1,000 red lights before." What's the cop going to say? "Oh, I didn't know you're pretty much a pretty good driver. I'll let you go." No, you are now a lawbreaker. No matter how many of the right things you did, you're now a lawbreaker. So do you see the illustration there? Here's another story about God's justice. We want God to be kind and kind of overlook these sorts of things. So how about this story? Your spouse, while you're at work one day, your spouse goes home for something and there's a burglar, and it surprises the burglar, interrupted, and hits your spouse really hard on the way out on purpose, whacks your spouse. And they catch the person, and the person is now going to go on trial, and you go there to see what happens. And the judge looks at you, looks at the burglar, and says, "You know, I want to be a merciful judge. I want to be kind. I'm going to let this person go." What are you going to say? You're going to say, "No, I demand justice." Well, why are we demanding that, but we want God not to be a God of justice? Okay, let's do one more story. What's the good news about God? I don't know if you've heard the story about the Native American and the thief. It's a powerful story. So there's a Native American chief who notices that some of their food has been missing lately. It's been stolen. Not much, but just some. So he makes this declaration. Then if we catch this person is going to be whipped. And that night, somebody is guarding and watching the food supply, and here comes someone in to grab a little bit, and they catch this person, and they bring this individual to the chief, and guess who it is? The chief's mother. And she was just really, really hungry, and she wasn't doing anything malicious about it, but the chief has already made a claim. If you are going to steal something, you're going to get punished. So the chief is in a dilemma. This is his mother. She could die from the whipping. But he's got to keep his word. So he says, "All right, let the whipping begin." And so they take the mom and they tie her to a pole, and the guy gets a big whip out, and the native chief comes up and says, "Just a moment." He takes off his shirt and wraps himself around his mother and says, "Let the punishment begin." Do you see the illustration there? It's a powerful story, isn't it? That's exactly what God did. God is a God of justice, and he's a God of mercy. How can he combine those two things to protect us, to save us, when we deserve his justice? Well, he can come and take the punishment for us, which is the story of Jesus. Okay, so here's my challenge after you hearing all these stories. My question is, what's your story? And maybe you've got some stories of science and Christianity. Maybe you know something about the history of science, that they're not enemies with Christianity. Maybe you've got some stories of tolerance and this new definition of tolerance that's going around. I have a talk on that. You can find it. The problem of evil. Maybe you've got a story from your life or something you've heard of. I've heard some powerful stories of people who've gone through terrible things, but it's brought something good to their lives. What about the doctrine of hell? Do you have a story about that at all? The existence of the soul? So these are some stories that we ought to have so that we can share with people, since that's what people remember. And for sure, if nothing else, please put together a story about an encounter you've had with Jesus. So maybe it's a conversion story. Maybe it's some miracles that you've seen. It's prayers that have been answered. It's support, thanks to Jesus, during tough times. These are the kinds of things that will impact people greatly. So, big picture, one more time. Do we still want information in our apologetics? Sure. I'm not opposed to that. I love having to make the case for Christianity using statistics and history and philosophy and things like that. But, one more time, we're living in a postmodern world that doesn't trust information as much as they trust stories. So this is a story-oriented society. They will love stories, and you need to have your stories. If you'd like to see where I got a lot of this information, where I got some of these ideas and the encouragement to write to create this talk, there's a book called The God Conversation, J.P. Moreland, M-O-R-E-L-A-N-D, The God Conversation. And he has a lot of different stories that I think are great. Contact me if you want some ideas. That's Gary@apologeticsforlife.org. So have some stories ready and be ready to share them. People will love them, and you'll get across a much better picture of Christianity.